Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist, where your special education questions meet expert answers. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor, a certified educational therapist, special educator, and your go-to special ed strategist, here to collaborate with families to access special education services, ignite student potential, and erase learning gaps. Together, we'll unlock the services and support your kiddos' needs to thrive. Let's get started. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com. Hello, and welcome to the Special Ed Strategist podcast, where we strategize all things related to special education. Today, I'm here with Dr. Perlmutter. He is the clinical director at the Chesapeake Center, specializing in ADHD and emotional resilience in children. He's also a board-certified psychologist with over 25 years' experience, known for using cognitive behavioral therapy to support kiddos with big emotions like anxiety and anger. He's also authored many books in as a parent, has a lens that's going to help guide us in our conversation today with understanding big emotions in students and children and how to support them. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You bet. Can you just tell us a little bit, maybe that I did not say, in terms of how you really help families strategize and support their kiddos so that they have greater access to independence, employment, education, and all of those good things?
So we have a problem in our culture where there's no marketing dollars for the science of psychology, for the things we know about what helps to understand and advance the human condition. So whether we're talking about parenting or couples work or family work, individuals, there's this huge gap between what the psychology of science knows really works and what people know. Because unlike medications or other things, there's no marketing dollars. So I really see my mission as being a bridge with the clients I serve. You know, here are the things that the science suggests would really be helpful here. And then by doing things like this, which, you know, I do regularly, delight in doing them to try to light some candle in the darkness.
Before we dive in to kind of help use that analogy of lighting candle in the darkness and talking about helping your children with big emotions, what is one thing that doesn't necessarily relate to what you do in your role that is a little known thing about you? Maybe it's a hobby or something you've done in the past that folks may not know about you.
Well, I tell all my kids in the first session, I said, you may not have heard, but I am also a wizard. So this is my actual wallet. I carry around with my little bit of money and my Metro card and things like that. So I use magic quite a bit in my work with kids and families.
For those of you that are listening, that was fantastic. It's this great wallet that Dr. Perlmutter has, and he pulled it out and it lights on fire, and which is pretty cool. And I would love to see the reaction of folks when you take that out to buy your groceries or whatever you do.
I love it. I get there's a dual reality reaction. There's whoever I'm doing it for. And then there's my adult children and wife who groan in agony when I do it. And as soon as I reach for it, they go, don't you dare light it. And I light it. So I get the delight of the waitress and I get the delight of their reaction too.
That's good. You're not doing your job unless you embarrass your kiddos, for sure. In a healthy way, I'm sure.
Yeah.
All right. Can you start by defining what we mean when we say big emotions in children?
Yeah. So usually that means where emotions are overwhelming the person and it's not going well. So you could have emotions overwhelming a person and it's going well. Like someone can get emotionally overwhelmed at their wedding or if their favorite team wins the Super Bowl or whatever. And all that works out fine. But we're talking about instances where it doesn't work out so well. And there are a couple of leading reasons why that tends to happen in kids, though the two I'll mention are not the only causes.
So what are some insights or signs that parents or educators might observe when they see this, and what are they looking for? What does that look like?
So often when kids have this as a struggle, they don't have control over it. You know, kids don't want to get in trouble at school. They don't want to be embarrassed in front of their peers at school. So if a kid is crying and or losing their temper at school, it's usually because they themselves don't have the capacity or knowledge on how to control that.
So we're talking about, what would those emotions look like? Crying, screaming, throwing?
Fear, anger, right? So sometimes it can be positive emotions too. I had one of my young men with ADHD went to college who was confused for a stalker as he was trying to connect with people he was interested in. So most of the time we think of it as like the sadness, anger, anxiety, but sometimes it can be not knowing how to handle affection and wanting to connect with people.
So from a psychology perspective, we're saying that we have these big emotions. What are the underlying reasons that kiddos are not able to kind of regulate or express those emotions? So we're talking about anger, anxiety, and you had mentioned a couple other ones.
So the two most common causes, at least in my practice with this, one is a temperament. And temperament means biologically influenced personality characteristics. And we're all an admixture of positive and unfortunate temperamental aspects. I mean, examples of temperamental advantages, you know, open to new experience, outgoing, hard to ruffle, adaptable to change. Those are all temperaments. You know, there are others who are inconvenienced by the presence of humans on the planet, you know, and have a hard time, are very oversensitive to emotions. There's a type of temperament. It has a few different names that have been used for it, but the most popular one right now seems to be the highly sensitive child by Aaron. And Aaron has an online quiz that parents can take. I believe there's 22 items in this quiz that will identify whether or not their child might have this temperament. And so, as is in the name, a highly sensitive means, I mean, I have that temperament. And those of us that have it, the upside is we see other things in the human condition that other people miss. We're aware of other people's emotions. We're better able to see the complex nuances as people connect with each other and relate. But on the other hand, we're overly sensitive to information. So like if I'm walking in New York City with my family and there's a police car, an ambulance that goes by, I'm the only one who has to cover my ears and bend over because it's just too much. And my kids are forever telling me in a playful way about how dramatic I am, you know, with my own emotions. Now, I've had the benefit of learning about this and knowing how to control them so that I try to accentuate the upside to that temperament and minimize the downside. But that's something you're born with. And often one or both parents have that same temperament. And there's parenting strategies that can be done to optimize it. The other most common example or reason, I think, is when someone has ADHD. There used to be thinking that maybe people with ADHD had bigger emotions, but that's probably not generally true. What does seem to be generally true is that most of us, to manage our emotions that we don't want to show, think about the next time someone annoys you in public and you're tempted to just give them a piece of your mind, but you don't do that. Usually it's because you've taken a moment to talk yourself out of it. What will that change? And maybe they're unhinged and could become aggressive, or I'll feel guilty later, or I'll have to tell the priest, whatever. You know, we self-talk, but with ADHD, there's not the pause to self-talk. At least unless someone has had effective treatment, the feeling just is on the sleeve and gets expressed, creating that sense of being dysregulated.
When we talk about, let's just go back for a second, the highly sensitive child. So mm-hmm. If this is biological, what part of that could also be kind of that nature nurture concept in terms of where is the exposure that a student has?
Yeah. So that's a really important question. And it's always something I cover first whenever I teach a course on childhood mental health. There's two models out there. There's the one parent as sculptor. So in that model, someone's born like a lump of clay and their parents and their environment fashion their personality. And the second competing model is the sculptor model, which is kids are already born with a lot of their personality, the range of it set, and really experience in parenting kind of refine where they'll fall within a given preset range. The theories about kids as being sculpted, those theories had to be authored by men who weren't around babies very much. Because if you're around babies, you can see they're very different even before their parents have had a chance to have influence. But still, that sculpting model is still very much in our, I used to go to, my kids are all in their 20s now, but when I used to go to school staffing, teachers would give me credit that I didn't, that really wasn't mine to own because they had the sculpting model. And my kid was doing great, so it must have meant I sculpted that as opposed to I was more shepherding, you know, along with my wife. So I think the science is pretty clear that the shepherding model is the one that's true.
Give me an example of that. What does that mean by shepherding model?
So if I have a child that's highly sensitive, let's say has that temperament, first of all, if I'm fortunate, I can educate myself about what that means. Reading the Elaine Aaron's book would be a good start. And then I can do things like help my child to modulate when they get upset, how to regulate it, while also leaning into the strengths of that temperament, you know, putting them in positions to see how their ability to see things other people don't see might serve others or might serve them, and trying to engineer those kinds of experiences. Self-esteem is made up of two parts, one part of which is an experience of competence, which involves a parent knowing what their child's top strengths are, and then trying to put them in situations where they can use those for the benefit of others. If I'm lucky, my kids' top strengths are in the areas that the herd travels. The herd travels, you know, in academics, the major sports. And if I'm lucky, my kid has top strengths in those areas. Lots of kids don't, however, but they still have top strengths. That's the thing. Everybody does, barring brain damage, brain injury, we all have top strengths. That's my math friend called, professor friend called that a mathematical certitude, that assertion. So figuring out what their top strengths are and put them in that situation. So a highly sensitive child and looking at the items in the quiz can give a parent a sense more for what the strengths are, because there's a mix in there of strengths and disadvantages. So trying to put them in places and situations where they could use those strengths. How many times have I seen treated a child with this temperament? I'd say a good third to 40% of the time, they end up telling me they want to be a therapist because they've sensed they have this aptitude. And the best therapists I know, almost to a person, have this temperament.
Taking a look at kind of that shepherding model and using strengths, how do we see big emotions showing up in a classroom? And then kind of the challenges that occur with big emotions within a traditional classroom model. And then how can we support as educators working with students who may be emotionally dysregulated or have big emotions?
Okay, so yeah, that's a very important and big question. I think in terms of how it manifests, it's, you know, anytime the kid experiences frustration or they're overwhelmed, that's probably when it's going to be seen. That's going to vary from kid to kid. Some kids, you know, being pointed out they've made a mistake is devastating. For others, it might be feeling socially embarrassed. That's the trigger. It can vary a lot. In terms of what to do, there's two general lanes we're in, right? If you're a teacher, there's, I'm able to partner with the parents. That's where we want to be. And I'm not able to partner with the parents either because of time or whatever. It's just not a choice. So I think your question sounds like it's more in the second lane, And kids can be taught fairly quickly and easily how to calm themselves. So when we're activated, those big emotions, it's the fight flight system in us called the sympathetic nervous system. God forbid any of us tonight, we hear the sound of broken glass in our house. We're on the third floor, it's on the first floor. We think someone's breaking in. Instantly, there would be dozens of changes in our body from brain down to our toes based on centuries of evolution, making us able to respond effectively. It's kind of like one of those science fiction movies where the starship's going into battle. They say, okay, take all the energy from the kitchen, put it into the shields. Nobody's on deck five, put it into the phasers. That's exactly how our body works when there's a threat. And it's very advantageous in those when there's a real threat. The problem is when there's not a real threat, a lot of those changes do not work for us at all. Like, for instance, the part of me that's most in charge that I access when I'm deciding what I want to do, the prefrontal cortex, that part takes a nap. Also, we get very tunnel vision on what it is that's jacked us up. We're not aware of other details. There's a substance called cortisol, which in short bursts is very helpful for dealing with a threat. In any extended way, it's a toxin in the body that brings all kinds of physical and psychological maladies along with it. So we all do well to be trained in how to interrupt the sympathetic nervous system, which can be done quickly. And I can illustrate it now if you'd like. But it's like there's a time bomb ticking and someone comes along and clips the wire. Like that's almost how quickly the sympathetic nervous system can be deactivated. If you'd like, I don't need to do it, but I have an exercise that lasts 3 minutes that anybody who wasn't driving could listen to and do along, you know, do this too.
Yeah, let's do that. I think it's incredibly important as you're explaining this. When we have our conversations here, I think about kind of that special educator lens, because that is what I used to do and always thread through, but also just a parenting lens as well. And it is often within classrooms or hallways, even now as a consultant, that I'll see kind of this explosion and I see different ways of approaching that student to kind of help regulate and kind of deactivate what's happening. So this would be incredibly important. Yeah, if you would love to walk us through it, that would be amazing.
Yeah, so the best way to learn about this is to actually do it. So I'm going to teach it to you guys like I would anybody who's in my office where we have 3 minutes. And I'm going to run a stopwatch here and then show that it will be exactly 3 minutes that this takes. So go ahead and close your eyes and get as comfortable as you can. And I'd like you to bring your attention to your breath. And breathe into your lower belly instead of your chest. Pretend that your lungs are there. So imagine you had two potato chips, one on your chest and one on your belly. The one on your chest should barely move, if at all. And the one on your belly should rise and fall so that someone across the room could see it easily. And when you breathe in more deeply than normal, pause 1001 at the top, and then breathe out more deeply than normal also. Keep breathing like that as we now turn our attention to your muscles. And try to relax your hands and fingers as much as you can. And now let it spread to your lower arms. Don't shake anything out, you're just using your mind. And now your upper arms. There are three qualities of a completely relaxed muscle. First is softness, of course. The second, though, is a sense of weight. So in a completely relaxed condition, it can almost seem like your arms are sagging out of your shoulder sockets from the weight of the relaxation. So sense that. Relax your shoulders and neck. If you go back to doing this again, you know, do it when you can have your head supported. Relax your jaw and tongue. Some people, when they relax their jaw, their mouth wants to open. If you're one of those people, let that happen. Relax your eyes. Make your forehead as smooth as a pond on a summer morning. Relax your chest, which should barely be moving, if at all. There's no breath there. Relax your stomach, which is rising and falling as rhythmically and as calmly as the waves come in and out at the beach on a calm day. The third element of a relaxed muscle is a sense of warmth. So a sense of warmth can start to envelop you at this point. Relax your upper legs. Feel your whole body sinking down into the furniture you're sitting in, almost like it's going to leave an indentation. Relax your lower legs. You can feel like your calves are sagging down your leg from the weight of the relaxation. And now your feet, ankles, and toes. Sometimes taking in an extra deep breath into your belly and letting out slowly can help, so do that. And once more. Okay, so how did that feel?
Well, that felt amazing. I feel like I could take a nap. I love that. This kind of reminds me of Shavasana in yoga class at the end where you're just letting it go. I do have a question though. So if we have a kiddo, whether you're a parent or an educator, and they have just exploded, right? So they've tossed a desk or whatever, spit, had all these reactions and emotions. How do we get this explosion of big emotions to want to transition to that beautiful 3 minutes that we just experienced?
So I would separate them from whatever environment they're in whenever possible, because that whatever it is that's triggering them is probably there, and then move them to some space and then do this. I have this exercise recorded just like this on YouTube, just called 3 minutes to a better you. So if you just enter my name and 3 minutes to a better you, and you can just play it. After you hear it a few times, you have it memorized. You don't need to keep going back to it. The metaphor with kids is pasta muscles. So you want to make your muscles soft, heavy, and warm like a cooked piece of pasta, and belly breathe. And if you can do that, if you can belly breathe and have pasta muscles, that's going to take you most of the way. Sometimes then a clear mind and to count breaths or look at a candle that's flickering, focus the attention there. It's physiologically impossible to be jacked up if I have pasta muscles, belly breath, and a clear mind. It's impossible. This exercise can be a Captain America shield against all the slings and arrows that would activate anger, worry, and stress.
That's a great analogy. So kind of from that parenting perspective, you have kiddos, I have kiddos, people that are listening tend to have kiddos. They're trying to figure out what to do. In the moment, it is very easy for the adult to feel either overwhelmed or wanting to respond to their emotions. What strategies do you encourage or teach so that the adult, whether it's a parent or professional, can kind of remain neutral and then help walk through the process?
So I have a suggestion for that, but two quick contexts for the suggestion. First of all we parents are crazy people. Our love for our child, it's like too big. I remember my first child was born. I had this feeling of like hard to draw breath, like I was breaking apart at a cellular level. And so that level of love makes us crazy. So we have to acknowledge that. Second, there's way too much parenting guilt among engaged parents. Premise I have is if you parent with intention, 51% of the time, 51%, you're at the head of the class, because we all mess up all the time. And on social media, we have these snow globe images people put out that are false. It's part of the reason I don't like the term work-life balance, because even though the concept of trying to make time for family over work is very important, it conjures up ideas of serenity and crossing T's and dotting I's at work and home. And I've never seen that. It doesn't exist. It's all about considered chaos and how I managed my considered chaos. So with that in mind, what I'm going to say is aspirational. I mean, I besides being a highly sensitive person, I'm Irish, so I'm always aspiring for these things that I'm talking about. And the same thing goes for me. One of my aphorisms I try to keep in mind and I share with my parents is aspire to zip it with high beats per minute. So try not to talk if your beats per minute reach into triple digits, unless you're running or jogging or something like that, or you're an NFL linebacker. Try to just not interact with other human beings until you can get your own sympathetic nervous system deactivated. It's worth the 3 minutes. And who doesn't have, our presidential candidates have 3 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. You go to stall a restroom or your car or whatever, and just interrupt the sympathetic nervous system, because we've lost too many IQ points when we're upset like that. I have never had someone say to me, geez, I really regret that I wasn't more spontaneous with my anger. But how many times have people said to me, I'm so glad I created pause. So, so glad. And we're talking 3 minutes. So that would be the first thing. And then the next thing would be to try to do the same thing for my child, to try to create their own interruption of the sympathetic nervous system. It helps if I've explained this in advance, and maybe we've done some of the relaxation on our own. And there's more, that 3 minute exercise is just putting one's toe in the bath. There's other more elaborate progressive muscle relaxation exercises that can be done too.
If we take a look at executive function and kind of changing gears a little bit, how does that play a role in emotional regulation?
Huge role. And it goes back to that thing about creating pause. The executive function, I subscribe to a theory authored by Russell Barkley, science-based theory, but I like it so much because it explains so much of what I see with the people I help that have ADHD. Barkley's idea is that the executive functions in ADHD are problematic because of a lack of pause. That it's like, it's pause that allows us to develop these more advanced skills. So just like, you know, corn is not going to grow in a field that's overly tilled. You know, if I'm always running a plow through it and churning up the soil, nothing's going to grow there, right? The soil needs pause to grow. These executive functions need an absence of behavior in order to flourish. So let's take another thing. We're always saying to a kid with ADHD, what were you thinking? Right? We say that to them. So let's take a boy. He's starting first grade. First time he's been asked to sit in a desk for a lot of period of the day. Sitting behind this girl, platinum blonde hair. Her mother puts colorful ribbons in it. And he just can't help but reach out and touch and upsets the girl. Teacher tries to get him to stop. He won't, sends him to the principal's office, calls up the parents. He's their firstborn. So this is like a comet hitting the earth for them. And so they set up a big contract with him. Listen, in order to play your video game, you can't touch that girl's hair. If you touch her hair, you're not going to be able to play your video. Now it matters to him because he lives for his Jedi video game. Following Monday, he goes in and within a few minutes, he's touching her hair. The chorus of adults says to him, what were you thinking? Right? Well, he wasn't thinking. He was too busy behaving. If he stopped, called up the information that he knows, thought about the consequences that could occur to him, then he wouldn't have touched her hair. But because of the ADHD and the lack of pause and the behaving, that executive function of self-talking himself into control needs more help. And that's what the medications help with. And that's what talking therapies help with, is to create that pause.
How do we do that in a classroom? How do we kind of bolster that lagging skill? And as educators, professionals trying to figure out, like you said, we create this plan, but clearly in there, and I've seen that so many times, I like that you pointed that out, there is this gap between what we want and how to get there. So what are some things that educators could do, or that you have seen other adults be able to do to kind of bolster that gap before we can take the next step and supporting that kiddo in a classroom.
It just takes a, I mean, first of all, in the case of ADHD, good medication treatment is going to help a great deal with that. Great deal. But in terms of behavioral interventions, anything that promotes the kid to pause for a minute. So there could be class projects on pausing, you know, setting up a really easy, thinking now for elementary school age kids, you know, a really easy, compelling question. And then saying, before anybody can raise your hand, we have to count five together, you know, and just illustrating what pause looks like. I think also talking about role modeling it, teachers' own, how they found their own pausing is good and helps them to stay acting with the intention that they like. I bet you anything, I haven't looked for this, but I bet you if those listening got off and just looked for strategies, pausing, classroom, I bet you there's all kinds of, because this idea of pausing is not new. It's new to a lot of the public because of that problem with the bridging I mentioned, but it's not a new idea in the science.
We can take a second to talk about medication. You've mentioned that a couple of times. Some parents think that it's a very personal, so it's a very personal decision, right? And there's a lot of information, misinformation about medication as it relates to ADHD. Do you have any insights that could help parents better understand the concept of it and the why behind it?
Sure. And any parent that has a child with ADHD, I recommend join CHAD. That's the National Support Organization. And CHAD does a very good job at creating science-based advice for parents. So it doesn't read like you're reading a scientific journal. It reads meant for parents, but it won't get published unless it passes the scrutiny of the professionals that are serving CHAD. So I would do that first. But in general, I can say that there are conditions, mental health conditions in children that I don't recommend an evaluation for medication out of the gate. Most anxiety and most mood problems that occur, kid may not need to be on medication if they get cognitive behavioral therapy for those conditions. And a lot of pediatricians, prescribers, don't know what CBT is. Again, there's no marketing dollars like there are for pharmaceuticals. Now, when it comes to ADHD, though, it's a very different story. The research is overwhelming in children. In adults, it's more complicated. But in children, it's overwhelming. You're anybody listening, if they just Google the MTA study, Martha Tom Apple study, that was a very detailed, in-depth look at this question of how do medication treatments compare to talking treatments and both together. And it's just a slam dunk what medications do. I hear some of the more popular concerns I hear among parents is, well, I don't want them to get addicted because I hear that one of the medications tried are stimulants. Actually, a kid with ADHD who's properly treated has a lower risk of addiction than a kid without ADHD or with ADHD who doesn't receive the treatment. So I have a colleague here, a psychiatrist. I heard him do presentation on this topic once and he made a great point. He said that a lot of times parents think about what's the risk of medication, but they don't necessarily think about what's the risk of non-medication and that all these scenarios involve some risk. And I'll tell you, I'll tell you one quick story. Adult I diagnosed with ADHD in her early 30s. And she went in for medication treatment, came back the following week, euphoric. David, you don't understand. I sat in my bathtub and I read for a half an hour. And I could have kept going and going and going. I've never been able to read for more than 10 minutes in my life. I thought I was stupid. I was so thrilled at being able to do this. The only reason I stopped reading is the kids were banging on the door, bugging me. I had to get out of the bathtub. Week after that, she's depressed. What could have been? I wanted to be a nurse. I thought I was too stupid. I thought I didn't have the academic ability to be a nurse. Why didn't anybody recognize, I'm talking the way she did, why didn't anybody recognize this when I was a little girl? My life could have been very different. I don't feel like I have the time and freedom now to do that. We don't want our kids singing that song as an adult. What I say to parents is let's get your daughter successful. Let's get your son successful. See what that looks like. And then within that context, we can have this larger philosophical debate sometimes about medication in the long run. Let's have that discussion within the context of success. Because once a kid, and it happens in elementary school years, once a kid thinks they're stupid and they can't do well in the academic machine, they have a different outcome. So other people raise other concerns. They'll get addicted. There's no evidence of that. They'll get the idea that you solve life's problems through popping a pill. Again, not if their treatment team is good, they won't. I often use the metaphor of glasses, you know, and I ask kids, you know, what would, I can't read well without my glasses, but imagine I didn't know that. And I thought it's just because I'm not trying hard enough and people are putting extra light in rooms for me and they're making sure the reading is a certain distance from my face and they're giving me a lot of cheerleading. And at the end of the day, I'm going to think there's something seriously wrong with me because I have a physical problem that needs a physical solution. And so too it is with ADHD.
We've talked about really the parents, you know, have this immense fear and love when they're parenting, right? Like it's just this leading with fear and love. And we have the medication component. So we have a kiddo with big emotions. We have the medication component, not for the sensitive child, but for the ADHD kiddo. Yes. Can you then weave in what you do with just sharing a little bit about what cognitive behavioral therapy is for folks that may not know, and how does this all kind of come together? So as a parent, if I'm listening, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is my kiddo. What's my first step? And then how is this all going to weave together to create the support team with the school and everything to grow our beautiful human?
Great question. So first of all, most kids with ADHD, a large majority, have at least one other mental health diagnosis too. You know, defiance, anxiety, mood are common. And so those treatments or the treatments for those things, the talking treatments are often superior to medical treatments for those things. Also, let's say hypothetically we had a kid with just ADHD. It's unusual for the medication to take care of all the symptoms. Some executive function problems remain. And so learning behavioral strategies or organization, time management, doing things when I don't feel like it, controlling my emotions can all be a part of it. Cognitive behavioral therapy, if the world's a humane place by the time all of our children are our age, will be taught in schools. It's just good mental health practice. It's very structured. It's very skill building. The way it should be taught, in my opinion, is kids are taught the skills and then parents are taught them also so that they can coach the skills in their kids. There are programs out there that just teach the parents these strategies. And I think that is unfortunate when we can't also teach the kid at the same time. And if I have a kid that's resisting that treatment, then there's behavioral interventions that can deal with that resistance because the kids do well when they receive this cognitive behavioral therapy. The only problem with cognitive behavioral therapy is you got to keep doing it. You got to keep doing the strategies. But that's true of our physical health. You know, there's certain things we can't just say, okay, I've exercised enough now, or I've eaten enough vegetables now. And so sometimes people act like our mental health practice should be different. Oh, I've been doing cognitive behavioral therapy principles for years. There's something wrong with it that if I stop, my symptoms return. Well, that's how it is with our physical health. So as long as, and it doesn't have to take a lot of time. Learning the strategies can take time. But once a person has them, it's all of my adults that come back or kids who come back for booster sessions 6 months, a year later, all tell me it doesn't take much time at all to do the maintenance.
And I would imagine the key would be that collaboration between the parents and the school or the parents and the team to really be able to have a dialogue of this is what we're working on, this is how we're going to prioritize it, so that you really have that communication and collaboration with everybody supporting that student or that kiddo.
And if I could suggest a brief script, if I'm a school person trying to connect with a parent lunatic, is to, first of all, make sure to have at least 20 minutes. This calling up saying, oh, I want to talk about a problem Peter has. We're too crazy for that to work most of the time. You know, it's like flying over a field and planting corn by throwing seeds over the sides of the dust crop of the plane. Well, maybe that's all I can do because of budgetary concerns, but then do I want to blame the seeds of the field when I come back and the crop is compromised? I need at least a 20-minute meeting face-to-face, and I start with, let me tell you the things I've noticed about your son that are just fabulous. And I'm not an Oreo cookieing them, you know, compliment it, start and finish, so I can deal with what I really want to deal with, which are the complaints. I, in my heart of hearts, have to believe that these are top strengths and I'm enjoying them about the child. And if that's in my heart, that's going to come across. Mom and Dad, what strengths do you see that I haven't mentioned that I can look on the lookout for? Now we're at least 7 or 8 minutes in. Say, okay, so all of us humans, we're always in process. We're always trying to be better. What do you think are your son's growth opportunities? A lot of times they'll name the very thing that I wanted to bring up as a teacher. But if they bring it up, now I can partner with them instead of sounding like I'm complaining about their child. So I give them empathy. It's not easy, especially if you're a parent yourself. You can say, listen, I know how hard it is to say what you just said. I'm a parent. Oh, thank you. I appreciate you trusting me with that perspective. You can offer empathy for it, say any manifestation of it you've seen, and then say there's a couple other things, because you don't have your son in a classroom at home. You haven't seen him in that situation. Of course, there's a couple other things I've seen that I'd like to share with you, because you guys are the world's leading expert on your boy and I need your help. You know, so here's what I'm seeing. And then you can collaborate more. So that's a 20-minute meeting. It's much more likely to work than the traditional, let me tell you about the problem we have.
I couldn't agree more. When I did case management work for students, I would always call in the beginning of the year with what you just said. So there wouldn't even be a problem. Yeah, just, hey, I'm introducing myself. This is what I've seen so far. These are things I'm really enjoying about this, this, and this, whomever that kid is. And just starting that dialogue really goes a long way. And that I did that before I even had kiddos. And now having kiddos, I really appreciate when an adult or professional that's working with one of my kids leads with that, right? Because you just, you know, you love your kid and you want to not always, you know, kids are not waking up wanting to be a jerk.
And it's the truth. It's the capital T truth about human beings, that there's all this beauty and strength that's there, even when the human being themselves hasn't dawned on them yet. I often tell my adult clients, we could mark this journey that we're taking with closing the gap between your version of how you view yourself and how I view you. And we're probably near the end once we have the same perspective. Because it's easy, because of my training and years of doing this, it's easy for me to see people's beauty and strength early on. And a lot of times people don't see that in themselves. They've listened to the lies their depression has told them for too many years.
Yeah. And it's hard for a parent because they have their own stuff that they're coming to the table with, and they are then trying to navigate the world with their beautiful human, and they come as they come and they're all so different, and you're just trying to navigate and build that resiliency and that beautifulness within each kiddo. So then how do we, either as professionals or parents or both, kind of strike that balance between empathy and enabling when we're kind of bringing it back into that, those big emotions that our kiddos are expressing or experiencing?
I would start with the premise that a harsh judgment reflects a distortion of the truth or an incomplete picture 100% of the time. And to think of harshness as psychological body odor. if one of us gets a message, we have body odor, we leap into action. Nobody goes, I stink, I'm okay with that. We should think about harshness in the same way, because it always represents distortion or incomplete information. That if I have the capital T truth of a person, the harshness goes away, which is not the same as saying that what they've said or done is okay. Empathy doesn't mean agreement. Empathy doesn't mean justification. But I'm not going to be able to get to agreement and justification if that person doesn't feel like I get them. So I want to start with empathy first. Especially we parent lunatics, we want to fix, we can't stand it when our kids are hurting and we want to jump in and solve it. But I got to give empathy for whatever they're feeling, showing that I get it. And then we can have the other discussion about, okay, so we talked about why you were feeling very angry today. And that was very understandable. What do you think it was like for your sister when you ripped up her magazine? What can you do to make that right? Because if you've had the empathy discussion, you're much more likely to have a person who's willing to acknowledge that they caused some harm. The people I know with regulation problems with their emotions are the number one haters of that problem. They hate it more than the people in their lives hate it. Now, maybe it's they've gotten defensive and combative, and so the other person doesn't see that. But in my experience, they hate it the most. And so we've taken the time to let them know, we know they're not some freak. There's a human condition that explains this. Then we can move on to reparation or what they can do next time to not lose control so quickly.
Out of our conversation today, what did I not know enough about to ask that I should have asked?
We've asked some pretty big questions for our big emotion discussion. I guess just, it's not so much we didn't talk about, but that marriage between my mental health as a parent and my kids' mental health, the, you know, just think that what they say, the airline people, when the oxygen mask drops. In my experience, there's so many households where the oxygen masks have long since dropped and everything's going on to the kids. And that's got to change, number one. I've got to have good self-care. And if I'm in a committed romantic relationship, good relationship care, front load that hour a week for each of those at least, and then start to prioritize this little creature as my child.
How do you recommend parents doing that, prioritizing that?
First of all, realizing this myth that we have in our culture that it goes, the time I'm going to give to self-care and relationship care is the time that's left over after I've gotten my obligatory stuff done. And that that extra time doesn't exist. I call it unicorn time with my families I work with. It doesn't exist. What important thing's not going to get done so that I can work out? What important thing's not going to get done so I can have a date night? A date night a week makes divorce obsolete. That's so important. What thing's not going to get done? Maybe my lawn looks like crap, or I drive a rust bucket for a longer period of time. Whatever it is that feels important in the moment, what am I going to let go so that my relationships and my own wellness are front-loaded into every week? There's a funeral exercise I have people do in my parenting book early on to imagine themselves on their deathbed, because the gift of death to the living is great wisdom. And you can also ask yourself, what would my deathbed self have me do in this moment of decision? Because relationship care, self-care, those are deathbed compatible activities. But the things that will interfere with self-care and relationship care are not. When I do parent groups, I'll sometimes do an imagery exercise where they imagine their own funeral. And then the light and the moon, I'll show a New Yorker cartoon where the man's on his deathbed. And he says to his younger child who's up by his bedside, I should have bought more crap, you know, to make fun of the idea that these things that interfere with what matters to us don't matter. Well, or matter as much, I should say.
You may have said this, but final question, if you had one tip for parents for a billboard, what would it be and why?
Spend an hour a week doing special time with your child. And to learn what that is, it's different from quality time. Again, by the way, folks, my YouTube, it's like an orphan child. I don't hardly pay it any attention. I don't care how many likes or hits or stars or whatever. I just don't care. But if you go to YouTube and just put in my last name, Palmiter, and special time, there's a 11 or 13 minute instruction video on how to do special time. An hour a week of that is the number one thing you can do to promote resilience in your children. And by resilience, I mean the adversity makes the human stronger, wiser, and better. It's not just surviving adversity, but the adversity makes you better. That's resilience. And special time is the thing that can most promote resilience in a child.
You have just given us, laid out some fantastic information, advice. I will put in our show notes how folks can contact you. I'll also put in some links for folks so that they can follow up. I'm sure they were taking notes as you were speaking and hopefully prioritizing things that make most sense to them and their world. So I appreciate your time and our conversation today.
Yeah, and people can feel free to call me. Probably the thing people start the most with, I don't mean to bother you, but they don't realize this is how I find meaning in my life. So folks can feel free to reach out.
I love it. I love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. Thanks for tuning in to the Special Ed Strategist. Remember, the right support can make all the difference. As your dedicated Special Ed Strategist, I'm here to guide, collaborate, and empower your kiddos' success. Keep igniting potential one step at a time. Until next time, take care and keep strategizing. Today's episode is brought to you by Learning Essentials and our Cracking the Code to Special Education Eligibility course. Empower your advocacy, erase confusion, and unlock the services your kiddo deserves. Learn more at learningessentialsedu.com.